Well, good evening to you, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you happen to be in the world. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from Salford, the magnificent city it is. I've got two very interesting guests for you today. I look forward to hearing from you via the website, via the app for the Richie Allen Show.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from the magnificent city of Salford.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, a little bit later on this hour, David Curtin returns to the program, the founder and the leader of the Heritage Party. David is also broadcasting these days. I want to talk to him about immigration. I want to talk to him about the fact that the Rwanda plan received royal assent today. It's live now. Will any planes take off? We'll talk about St. George's Day, clashes in London, more besides David Curtin this hour. A little bit later on, another excellent journalist and broadcaster, but not a politician, Gerardo Colmón will be on the programme, Irishman living in Paris. He's got a terrific Substack account. He has a brand new book coming out real soon. Lots to talk about with Gerardo Colmón. That will be Thursday's Richie Allen Show with me, you wouldn't believe it, Richie Allen. Lovely, enough of that old shite. You know what I did? I deleted my bullet points. Ah, sure, I'm so professional these days. I deleted my bullet points and then I absolutely deleted the recycle bin, which is funny. But it's okay. I think I remember pretty much what I was going to say to you for the next half an hour. I'll wing the bejesus out of it, you know.
Let me be clear. The Richie Allen Show is the greatest radio show of all time.
There you are, because I'm going to wing it. That's what I'm going to do. Thank you, Barack. Thank you, thank you. Why did you do that? I don't know. Have you done that yourself a few times? Just deleted your bullet points. Anyway, it matters not. I remember what I was going to talk to you about. So the Rwanda plan then. Listen, we're going to talk Israel, of course, later. Maybe with David, certainly with Gerardo Colmón and what's happening there. We'll talk about it in a moment. But I want to get into this Rwanda plan, the government's ingenious idea to rid the country of unwanted, illegal migrants. Yes, migrants who somehow come across the channel on very unseaworthy vessels and craft. This isn't funny, of course. A number of people have died, including very recently. But I want to draw your attention now that it has received royal assent and that if they choose to, the government can put some migrants on a plane and send them off to Rwanda. Now, that won't be as straightforward as it sounds because there will be other legal remedies open to the migrants, namely the European Court of Human Rights. The UK is still signed up to that, by the way, just in case you didn't know. Anyway, there was an extraordinary thing going on Twitter today. You know, these things, they go viral. You know, something is viral. And it said, Ben Habib is viral. Now, Ben Habib is the deputy leader of the Reform Party, which is run by Richard Tice. Its honorary president is Nigel Farage. Ben Habib, well, he's been called every name under the sun today, because it has been alleged that in an interview with Talk Radio's Julia Hartley Brewer, he said, now this is what is being alleged, you and I will make our own minds up, he said, we should let the migrants drown. Did he really?
You establish a force that's well-trained and well-equipped, yeah, and capable and then of intercepting these dinghies, and you stop them entering our territorial water, and then you require them to turn round.
You require them to turn round. They go, we're not going to turn round. We're just going to keep going.
And then you have a standoff. You have a standoff in the channel, and then
all the migrants jump into the water. What do you do then?
And you might. This is one idea. Provide them with another dinghy.
I love this. So they jump into the water. I don't find people, you know, fighting for their lives in the freezing cold waters of the channel funny. I don't. I find this situation funny. In case you've just come across the programme for the first time, I'm not an inhuman monster. I don't find anything funny about it. As a man who comes from a nation of people who had to travel around the world to find our fame, not our fame, our fortune, and our infamy. Infamy is probably a better way of putting it. So that's what we did. Well, I find this absolutely absurd. So they jump into the water. What do you do then, says Julia? We give them another dinghy, says Ben Habib.
in order to climb back in.
And then they say, we're
get back into the dinghy we've just given you and turn around and go to France.
Going to keep going to England. What do you do?
And then you use force again. And I'm afraid.
Use force again.
So at some point.
This is great.
Wait. At some point, you know, the Royal Navy or any other body, the Border Force, they're going to have to pick these people out of the water or off a dinghy that's not seaworthy.
Yeah, because that's what decent people do. There are people stranded in the water, and irrespective of what you might think about them and their motivations, you hold them out as quick as you can, because that's the Christian thing to do, right?
Okay, at that point, what do they do with them? But do they take them back to France or not? What do they do with them?
The presumption in your question is that we have a duty of care to people who are seeking to enter our country illegally.
We have a duty of care to people drowning in the channel, yes.
Well done, Julia.
Well, we only, by the way, under international law, Article 98 of the UN Convention of Law of the Sea, we only have an obligation to save people if it's reasonable to do so.
If it's reasonable. Is it reasonable? There's a guy over there, he's gone down and come back up about four times, but he's spending more time under the water. Do you think it's reasonable to fish him out? What do you think there?
And under the same international law, we have the right to turn people back who are seeking to enter our waters illegally.
I understand her. I love it, turning people back. At the point when they refuse to be turned back, or they just someone just puts a knife into the dinghy and it starts deflating, or they jump into the water because they've been told that's what you do and then you'll be picked up. You know as well as I do, anybody who has ever been on a boat will know that the rules of the sea are very clear. You have to save life where you can save life. And that is what...
Only if it's reasonable to do so.
It will be reasonable to do so because there'll be people drowning.
I don't think it's reasonable.
Are you genuinely saying the Reform UK policy is we will let people drown to make a point? Because I think that's what you're saying.
Ben, is that the policy of the Reform Party? If you were to form part of the next government, they won't, by the way. The Brexit Party and UKIP never achieved a single seat. I don't think Reform will win a seat, but then what do I know? But imagine you do, Ben, and you're part of the next government. Is it your policy, Ben, to leave people to drown in the channel, Ben?
Julia, if someone comes... let's not infantilise these people.
Just answer the question.
They have free will. They were safe in France. They paid good money to get on a boat seeking illegally to come. So I'm not going to infantilise them, and I'm not going to be held to ransom by their claim that they deserve protection as soon as they get into our territorial waters.
I agree with all of that. At the point when they use the tactic of jumping into the sea and they're drowning... Are you saying that British Border Force and the British Navy will be instructed not to rescue those people from drowning?
No, you didn't hear me. I said that we could, as an idea, provide them with another dinghy into which to climb.
Oh, yeah, we got to remember, you've got the offer of a second dinghy. And if you jump off of that into the water, well, sure, look, we've done all we can. Good luck, lads.
And then go back to France. And if they choose to scupper that dinghy, then yes, they have to suffer the consequences of
their
actions.
Then you would leave them to drown.
They cannot... They cannot be infantilised to the point that
I have
we
no doubt, Ben, that that is a policy
fortune.
That would work quite well. However, that is not a policy that a civilised country.
Is it just me, or are conversations occurring on radio programmes becoming ever more bizarre? So Ben Habib is getting it in the neck, Benjamin, because he said, let them drown. He didn't. I mean, in reality, he probably wouldn't let people drown. I don't know what sort of a human being Ben Habib is, but there you are. What say you, dearest of listeners? What's going to happen? Will they ever put people on a plane to send them to Rwanda, where they will not be processed, where they will stay and build a new life, will they? I mean, the British government has given... Well, I've got to double-check. Again, what did I do? I torpedoed my bullet points. Because I do make little bullet points so that I've got one or two facts when I need them. And I did have it written down exactly how much money the Rwandan government has thus far received from the Brits. And it's quite significant. It's a couple of hundred million quid, I believe. Whether a plane will take off or not is anybody's guess. Would you please reach out to the Richie Allen Show? Would you? You can find me via the app. Download the app, please. Or you can find me via the richieallen.co.uk. And I'm on the page today. I'm on the page. Thank you. I'm on the page. Listen, number of you are asking about the website. The website is going to be rejigged and revamped, and it's going to look different. But it's not going to happen overnight. And it will have a few new and sexy features when it is redone. It hasn't been done for a few years now. Okay, leave it with us. I'm a one-man band, you know. I do have some help from some lovely people, but they've got full-time jobs, you know. That's how it's going to be. In the meantime, download the app and send me a message instantly. Press send on the app. The message arrives at my screen in a matter of a millisecond. Hello to Keely. Keely is listening in Egypt with Gail. They're on holiday and they're listening in Egypt. Good evening to Keely and Gail. Have a fantastic time in Egypt. Sounds lovely. Hello to Johnny and Brent. Hi, Johnny. Richie. They're quick enough to show pictures and videos and report on the trouble on St. George's Day up the city. But the media was very silent on the trouble in Southall, West London on Eid, says Johnny. Thank you, Johnny. And I mean this when I say it. What happened in Southall, West London on Eid? Maybe I did see a video, maybe. Chris says, rubber dinghy rapids. Yes, they could do that. They could build a wave machine. They could build a wave machine in the channel. You remember years ago we used to go to Splash World when we were kids with all the slides, and then they brought in a pool into Splash World where it made waves and you could surf on it. Maybe they could do that. That's another way of drowning the migrants. They could bring a wave machine. I wonder what Donald Trump, the great Donald, would... what would he do? Because, of course, he had his immigration problem, didn't he, in America. Remember when he ran for election in 2016, he talked a lot about keeping out the Mexicans. I wonder what he makes of all of this stuff in the channel.
I agree. Let them drown, then build a wall on the seabed and police it with mermaids.
What?
I agree. Let them drown, then build a wall on the seabed and police it with mermaids.
Ah, brilliant. So build a wall on the seabed of the channel and police it with mermaids. And that will keep them out. I'm having great fun with the AI, you know that? Might come back to haunt me. Lewis says, Richie, you can see what is coming down the line after the tragic deaths in the channel. The next Labour government will scrap the Rwanda debacle and bring in safe routes of immigration, which will be an open-door policy. That's according to Lewis. Thank you, Lewis. David in Blackpool says, Richie, the Reform Party, David says, are profoundly racist. They don't like migrants with brown faces, but they do like them with white faces. For example, Ukrainians with Tice, the leader, with his evil-looking eyes, says David. Tice was also pro-mandatory COVID vaccine. Thank you, David. That's David's opinion. I'm not here to endorse or to criticise the opinions. Les says, Richie, Australia had a similar problem. They turned the boats back once the migrants realised they weren't going to get into Australia, says Les, and then didn't finish it. I'm guessing, Les, you meant to go on to say the numbers attempting to reach Australia probably decreased, I think you meant to say. Hi to Wendy. A lot of conversations on radio are total bollocks, Richie. Common sense needs to return to the world. The mouth on you, Wendy, the mouth on you. Atta girl, I agree with you 100%. Now let's talk about the media. I love talking about the media because I'm a boring old fecker. I bore myself. You know, I've been speaking to you for many years about how the media works. Not in a condescending or patronising way. I know that you get how the media works, but I'm a real student of the history and, more importantly, the evolution of the media. How, at one time or another, going way back, how 40, 50 years ago, I'm not saying now that 40, 50 years ago there was a perfect and reliable media. Of course not. I'm not saying that. But at the time, it was a far more respectable, at least appearance-wise, media where a well-dressed man or woman, very stoic-like, would read out some facts as gleaned by that person's organisation. No spin would be put on the facts. Now, I hear you screaming at me, but they probably weren't facts back then, Richie. Yes, yes, of course. In many cases, they were not. But no spin was put on these facts. And oftentimes, the newsreader would get comment from both sides of the argument. The newsreader wouldn't dare offer an opinion because he or she wouldn't last very long. It's how it used to be. The news. There was no 24-hour rolling news. We had news at 1 p.m, 6 p.m, and 9 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you were an ITN news watcher. So that's how it used to be. News, as we knew it, has been replaced mostly, nearly entirely, by commentary. echo chambers now, where people watch the news channel they like because the presenters are saying the things they like. Now, recently, Ofcom, the broadcast regulator here in the UK, has had a pop at GB News in particular for giving jobs to serving politicians, giving them their own programmes. See, people like Richard Tice, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Nigel Farage, who isn't a serving politician, okay, okay, but he's a politician. And there's been a lot of controversy about this. Is it right? Is it wrong? Why do we have this? Why has commentary arrived on the shores of the UK? Why can't we have news without opinion? And why can't we have genuine debate and whatnot? Now, I came across a very interesting, let me grab a little notepad here, a very interesting podcast today presented by Nick Robinson from BBC Radio 4. I know I'll wash my mouth out after this broadcast. I can't believe I said Nick Robinson was interesting. Anyway, he interviewed Stuart Purvis. Now, if you know your news, you'll know that Stuart Purvis used to be the boss of ITN. And they were discussing Ofcom and Ofcom's determination to restore impartiality to news broadcasting here in the UK. And I don't believe that Ofcom really wants to restore impartiality. But that's the claim in any case. So former ITN guy, Stuart Purvis, speaking to the BBC's Nick Robinson about impartiality. And I think you'll find it very interesting indeed.
What has happened in the market overall is that there's a market for a single view. And there's nothing wrong in that in terms of print, in terms of online. But broadcasting is offering something special.
So he says, Purvis, that offering a single view is okay in newspapers and magazines because newspapers have opinion pieces like Peter Hitchens. We know the things Peter Hitchens believes. We know what his politics is. We know. So we go to Hitchens' opinion. He's giving an opinion. It's pretty clear that it's opinion. That's good for the newspapers, says Stuart Purvis. But broadcast media shouldn't be like this. It should be impartial, he says.
It's offering a guaranteed range of views. And it's obviously, in terms of due impartiality, a very focused balance on any particular issue.
I don't know where Stuart Purvis has been for the last 4 years. Do you remember any balance around lockdown time, March 2020? Anyone? Any balance when some very famous doctors were saying, don't take the feckin' jabs? Jesus, we don't know anything about them. Do you remember seeing any of those docs on the BBC? Not me.
Let's come to defining that funny legalistic word, due, because it does...
Due impartiality. So this is Nick Robinson now.
...really matter in a little while. But here's a counter-argument. And it's not new, actually. James Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's son, used to be the chairman of BSkyB, the parent company that used to make Sky News. And this is what he asked in a speech in which he attacked broadcast regulation as a form of authoritarianism. How, he asked, can we justify this degree of control in one place and not in others? Why do we continue to assume that this approach is appropriate for broadcasting, especially as one communications medium is now barely distinguishable from another? Here's the crucial bit. Would we welcome a world in which the Times was told by the government how much religious coverage it had to carry, in which there was a state newspaper with more money than the rest of the sector put together and 50% of the market? The effect of the system, he went on to argue, Murdoch did, is not to curb bias. Bias, he said, is present in all news media, but simply to disguise it. We should be honest about what this is. It's an impingement on freedom of speech and on the right of people to choose what kind of news they watch. 2009, he gave that speech.
Yeah, he said that back in 2009, did James Murdoch. And he said, just to sum up what he said, as Robinson summed up, but Robinson didn't do a great job of summing it up, you know. Why should the print media be allowed to post opinion pieces? And why should that be denied to commercial television stations? Shouldn't they be allowed to do whatever news they like and put whatever spin on it or slant on it they like and let people decide for themselves which news channels are the news channels for them? But there's a huge problem with this. Echo chambers are about the worst thing in the world right now. They're everywhere. The independent media itself is just one massive echo chamber with content creators interviewing, in inverted commas, people who completely see things the same way they do. It's a circle jerk, right? And they want to, and they've already done this, introduced this circle jerking to commercial and to national media. They've done it. It's here and it's here to stay, you know. And it's a terrible thing. It's terrible for the growth of people. It's terrible for an individual's growth, for his or her education and understanding, to be constantly hearing people who see things exactly the same way they do. That's terrible. So, of course, there should be a place for 100% impartial news presentation and gathering. But sadly, we're never going to see it here in the UK, you know. Anyway, let's hear Purvis kind of wrap this up, because it's good what he says.
Well, it goes again to the question of the balance between the regulated and the less regulated markets. So there's broadcasting, there's newspapers, which have effectively a self-regulatory model, and then you have a pretty much unregulated model online. If you take that as a universe, if you like, of news and comment, that is a healthy balance in my view. It's part of it where there's a way of guaranteeing this range of voices, and then there is a freedom at the other extreme to say what you like within the law of the land. Why would anyone want to get rid of a certain part of that market where you are guaranteed some kind of impartiality, some kind of balance?
He says, why would anybody want to get rid of it? But as I've already demonstrated, it's gone. It's absolutely gone. The BBC says it will not allow or permit a climate change sceptic to appear on any of its programmes. Even though many climate change sceptics are very qualified men and women and have a right to an opinion on the climate. So where is this utopia that Purvis wants to preserve, I would ask? I don't see it anywhere. I see censorship everywhere, whether it's GB News, whether it's Talk TV, whether it's LBC, BBC itself, the national broadcaster, censorship. And most of the independent media, the truthers, practice censorship, even not consciously but subconsciously. They don't even try to find the other side of an argument and introduce them and bring them on, you know, for shits and giggles or just to break the monotony. So I don't know where it is, this utopia he's speaking
of. I can't see the point of abolishing that. I could see a very strong argument for not allowing it to go any further, if you like, encroaching, as you might call it, into the other spaces. But I cannot see the argument for abolishing a safe space. Because what happens if you do is what happens in America, where you have this, basically, you choose the outlet you want to listen to or watch based on your own politics. It's the way you just hear what you think already, and there's no way of hearing another view because the people you're listening to don't give you another view.
No, and it's here already. The stable door was unlocked. I can't remember the cliche. You can't lock the stable door after the horse is bolted. Is that the cliche? It's too late, Mr. Purvis. Stuart Purvis there. Yeah, right. Okay. This is The Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from BBG Towers here in the heart of Salford.
Hi, I'm Nicolas Cage. When I'm in the UK, I never miss a chance to listen to The Richie Allen Show.
Fantastic. Right, it's 23 minutes past the hour. David Curtin will be on the programme shortly. You don't want to miss him. Garrodo Colmón will be on later. Les came back to say, good shout, Les. Richie, don't forget the deal with Rwanda allows some of their people to come to the UK. That's right, Les, which makes it even more farcical. So we'll send the asylum seekers we don't want to Rwanda, and people fleeing Rwanda can come here. So you declare Rwanda to be a safe country, and then you say, well, we'll take... Enough. Enough! Hi to Dario. Thank you, Dario. I believe the Kalergi plan is not a conspiracy theory. My country, or better said colony, Croatia, changed in literally a few weeks after entering the Schengen zone. I get you, Dario. I get you. So within weeks of entering the Schengen zone, Croatia changed. Now we have a few hundred thousand migrants living amongst us, says Dario. Also, I believe this is the plan that the banking oligarchy is pushing forward to keep the status quo, because the salaries will go down or at best stay as they were before the obvious inflation started. Well, put, Dario, and I know that English is not your first language. Good man. I get your point completely. Hi to Anthony, who says, yes, they will be put back on boats, but they have no documents, so we need to give them digital ID so we can keep track of them. Problem, reaction, solution. And that's exactly what Tony Blair's Institute is calling for. Well said, Anthony. Hi to Ardal. Richie, not on the Rwanda subject, but an article in the Daily Express today reported that Glasgow will be launching a free public transport plan. I didn't see this, Ardal. Thank you. Yes, this is happening right across Europe. This is how they're coming for our cars. And I don't want to sound like fucking Alex Jones, but that's what they're going to do. They're determined to get us out of our own cars and to take our cars and our vans. One of the ways they're going to do it is make public transport completely free for everybody in cities. And they're doing this in Europe. France is all over this. Well said, Ardal. Hi to Grace. Good to hear you, Richie. It's £169,000 per person to send them to Rwanda. Wow. Hi to Ian Horton. Richie, he's recommending a guest. Thank you, Ian. I interviewed that man before, I think. Peter says, Blunkett says the way to stop the boats is a digital ID. Problem, reaction, solution, same old playbook. Hi to Phil. He says, Reggie Buzzinkay got a rollicking for smiling as he reported firemen rescued a cat from up a tree, then ran it over on the way back to the station. Great days back then, says Phil. It's time for music. And then David Curtin. It is the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live Monday to Thursday, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. There's a daily newspaper podcast which will drop Monday to Friday at 7:30 a.m. Sure, aren't I just giving the stuff away, aren't I? This is Roy Orbison. Anything. Music from Roy Orbison, that you got it from Mystery Girl. Yeah, that's the one. 29 and a half minutes, it is past the hour of 4 o'clock. The Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from Salford. BBG Towers, the only man-made object in Salford. You can see from Blackpool Tower. Believe it or believe it not, because the Earth is flat. I'm joking, it isn't really. It's a dodecahedron, apparently. That's what I heard. David Curtin is one of life's good guys, isn't he? Former teacher. These days, he is the leader of the Heritage Party, which he founded. And much to the chagrin, much to the annoyance of Ofcom, he's also become a broadcaster recently as well. David, I can't believe you became a broadcaster. What's going on? Welcome back, by the way.
Hi, Richie. Good.
How are you?
Good to join you again on your show. And I got my own show now, which is really exciting.
It is.
I've been doing it for just over 2 months now. Over on TNT. So I'm enjoying that, doing what you're doing very much. So it's a new thing for me, but it's all good.
More power to your elbow. Give a big sell to the program then. It's weekdays at 10 a.m., isn't it?
That's right. It's on TNT, 10 to 11, Monday to Friday. And you can watch it live on tntradio.live. And I put some catch-up clips on my YouTube channel. And then on the TNT site, you can see catch-up as well. So have a look, either live or afterwards.
Well, well done. I mean, you're born to it. I mean, not because you're a politician now, but you're born to it as a teacher, speaking and chatting and opining. So great stuff. No, I was giggling about the Ofcom stuff. You know, Ofcom is not happy with GB News. Now, of course, you're not a politician in the same way that some of these morons who have got their own programmes on GB News and LBC. You're a different type of animal, a different type of human being altogether. But what do you make of it? What do you make of Ofcom's interest in, you know, going after broadcasters and saying, you shouldn't be giving Jacob Rees-Mogg a bloody programme. He's an MP and he shouldn't be able to sit there on air every evening and deliver the Tory manifesto kind of unchallenged. What would be your opinion on that now that you've experienced both sides of that divide yourself?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, Jacob Rees-Mogg should be in the House of Commons making laws and voting on things that affect the UK. That's what he's employed to do. He shouldn't be on a show, I don't think. I mean, but, you know, that is not to that I agree with the fact that Ofcom have got any power over it. I mean, Ofcom is a regulator that has got far too much power. It's seeking more and more power every year. So I don't think that it's Ofcom's job to say to any broadcaster, you must cancel this person, you must cancel that person. And the thing about it in this country is that they insist on impartiality, or that broadcasters should not display bias in news programs or current affairs programs, which you actually don't have in the United States and other countries around the world. I mean, there's the First Amendment. A news broadcaster can say what they like. They can be as biased as they want. And the thing is, I think in this country, even though there is, you know, technically they are unbiased because they do everything to jump through the hoops that Ofcom says they should jump through, they are all biased anyway, and most of them have a very, very progressive, liberal, cultural Marxist bias. GB News is slightly different to that, but I've been on there a few times over the last 2 years, and I'm getting more and more frustrated in going on, because I used to have more of a free rein to say what I wanted to say, but if I go on now, I'm up against someone who's, you know, I'm the right-wing person, then there's a left-wing person, and they think they've done a good job if they get us arguing. So I don't really have much of a chance to put my point of view across without having someone cutting me down and smearing me, but that's just how it is. But it's not particularly healthy, and I don't see that it actually does much good anymore.
You've made some brilliant points there. There's a number of things to quickly unpick out of this before we go and talk about the Rwanda plan, and before we talk about St. George's Day, and obviously the dreadful education news in recent days that kids are doing terribly in mathematics and English. But you made some brilliant points there. To an untrained ear, it might have sounded like you were bitching about the fact that you were brought on a programme and that you had to deal with somebody who disagreed with you, but that's not what you said at all. I heard exactly what you said. You're brought on for a very short segment. The presenters are trying to get a viral video out of it. They're trying to get a bit of a heated discussion. And there's no real nuance or time for it because you don't have enough time. Ideally, you'd want a half an hour or an hour, and then you could have a proper debate with the Liberal, and the Conservative on the other side. So that's a brilliant point. I'll tell you where I am. You are 100% right to say it doesn't exist. I played some audio earlier from Stuart Purvis, the former ITN boss. He seems to think that we need to preserve impartiality. I agree with you, we don't have it. But in an ideal world, I would prefer, David, that we didn't have entire news channels dedicated to a single point of view, because I don't think echo chambers are healthy. I think what's healthy is what you and I have been doing for several years. We've butted heads on certain issues. We agree, we don't agree, things we see differently. That's very healthy, where you have time to do that. I'm not trying to beat you. You're not trying to beat me. You're a very, very articulate bloke. I'm nearly as articulate as you. Listener gets to make his own mind up. That's the utopia for me. If you could do it, let's bring back the old way of doing it. Let's have programmes where we have panel shows with everybody represented. The interviewer has no say whatsoever. Everybody gets equal time. And it's the long form debate, but we don't have that anymore. And I suppose that's my soapbox for today. What say you?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I mean, it's lovely coming on your show, and, you know, we don't always agree on everything, but we can have respectful arguments where we agree on some things and we disagree on other things. And, you know, my show as well that I'm doing is lovely, because I get a chance to speak for 5 to 10 minutes every day. I can develop an argument. I can put nuances in, and I can weave different aspects of what's going on into one feature. And that's great. And then I have a guest on, or two guests on, like you do, and we talk for 15 to 20 minutes and we have a long conversation, and you give people some space to talk, and that's very nice. I mean, I think, you know, where I might slightly disagree with you is I think the market should be able to decide what people want in terms of media. So if you had, you deregulated broadcasting and news broadcasting so that there was no requirement to be impartial, then you would have some news outlets that would continue, which would continue to try to achieve impartiality, and then you'd have different news outlets springing up to cater to different groups of people who want to watch different things and different opinions. And I think that's fine. And everybody should have the freedom to decide what they want to watch and what they want to think.
Can I butt in? Can I butt in? Can I butt in if you don't mind?
Yeah.
But isn't that detrimental to emotional growth, to spiritual growth, to education? Isn't it important that we hear views and opinions that we don't necessarily agree with? And that with the market dictating it, as you said, ultimately people eventually, they will go to where they hear what it is they want to hear. And that's just not great for our development, I would argue, David.
You know, maybe, because, you know, I can see what you're saying, but then who is the arbiter of what people should watch? Should not the market, should we not be free to decide what we want to produce and what we want to consume, if you like, if you put it in those, you know, the horrible sort of capitalist terms there, but that's essentially what we're doing when we engage with media. Otherwise, you have someone deciding what's best for somebody else. And, you know, maybe someone is able to decide what's best for other people. But in general, I think people can decide what's best for themselves when they're an adult. But when they're adults, we should have the freedom to decide what we produce and what we watch.
Good point, but I'm going to counter that by saying, didn't we see back in 2020, almost in lockstep, Good Morning Britain, LBC, the BBC, ITN, of course, which is also ITV, even GB News, not GB News, excuse me, no, it would have been Talk TV, they were all, again, without the sort of regulation I would have liked to have seen, there was no place for the dissenting voices against lockdowns and ultimately against vaccines. And that's the problem you have when you don't have anybody trying to ensure that the public is getting the best representation of a wide range of views. When you don't try and ensure that through legislation, you miss out, because they put on the doctors they wanted to put on, didn't they, David, to say, we got to lock down, we got to destroy the economy. But they were able to get away with not presenting to me and to my neighbours and my fellow citizens the other point of view. That's my final point on it. You have the final word on this before we move on.
Exactly. That's exactly what I mean. In the lockdown period, Ofcom said, broadcasters, you must have this line. You cannot allow medical misinformation. There was someone from the state, someone from high up, dictating what everybody said, and there was no freedom. So if you took away those restrictions, then you could have other media outlets being free to counter what was being said and to talk about getting out of lockdown, using hydroxychloroquine, vitamin D and all those kind of things. That would have been better.
Look, I'm going to have one final quick word on this, and then you definitely get the final word, and then we'll talk about immigration. Yes, look, I'm not trying to beat you here. I see what you're saying. But the free market way, I believe, in the future, would ultimately lead to those who consider themselves to be socialists or liberal believing the media outlet that tells them you've got to have the vaccines and you've got to lock down, and that if you don't, well, you're a horrible, hateful person who doesn't care about your fellow human beings. And the conservative media would say the opposite, and their listeners who believe that would flock there, and you just have that culture war type of thing, back and forth, and nobody would ultimately be any the wiser. Definite final word on this to you, then we'll talk immigration. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think that having both of those things would be better than just having the one thing, because at the time you were only allowed what the former thing that you mentioned, the sort of totalitarian viewpoint that we all had to lock down and we all had to social distance from each other until we were told that we were let out. So I would rather we had a free market than a single totalitarian point of view.
You are listening to David Curtin. David is a politician, the leader and founder of the Heritage Party. He's a broadcaster. Catch him on TNT Radio 10 a.m. weekdays. And he's a former teacher. We will talk education in a few minutes. Before that, Ben Habib has been getting it in the neck online anyway. I'm sure he's got a brass neck, so maybe he doesn't care. He appeared to say to Julia Hartley Brewer on Talk TV, look, when we go out, we should send out a trained force to the rubber dinghies. We should offer them another dinghy and say to them, head back to France. If they don't take that, they should be left to flounder in the water and drown. I don't believe that. My Christian friend David Curtin believes in allowing anybody to drown. This is the most ludicrous situation. This Rwanda bill has officially gone live as it received royal assent today. What do you make of this story, the way it's being reported, the Ben Habib comments, and what the bloody hell, David, can anybody do about these dinghies coming to the country, 300 to 400 people a day? What's going on? What can be done about it?
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, first of all, I'll start with the Rwanda bill that's gone through Parliament, been given royal assent today.
Yeah. But
I think, as I said 2 years ago, this is a complete farce. It is just there to throw some red meat in election time to the fake Conservative Party's voters who've abandoned them because they haven't got a grip on immigration, and they've been allowing mass immigration to get bigger and bigger and bigger and more people coming in over their 14 years in power. And now there's an election coming up and they want to be seen to be doing something. So they want to get a flight off the ground to Rwanda before the general election, and then Rishi Sunak can say, oh, we're doing something to stop the boats, which is absolute nonsense, because there's going to be 200 people going to Rwanda to stay in a 200 bed hostel in Kigali, and maybe there'll be some more people going after that. But actually, the Rwanda scheme is not a deportation scheme, it is an exchange scheme, and that's what people don't realize. If you look at the small print of the memorandum of understanding between the UK and Rwanda, section 16 of that actually talks about making arrangements for the UK to resettle a portion of Rwanda's most vulnerable refugees in the UK. So 200 people will go to Rwanda, and then 200 people will get on the plane in Rwanda and come back to the UK and be given medical treatment and mental health care treatment and things that aren't available in Rwanda. So the whole thing is an absolute farce, and it is not worth the paper it's written on. But, you know, I do say that we do need to push the boats back to France. I don't want anyone to be drowned, but we can, you know, pick them up and take them back to the beaches of France, or push, you know, get a tow line and tow the boats back to France, maybe before they've got too far across the English Channel. But what we certainly shouldn't be doing is sending the Border Force and the Royal Navy and the RNLI out to the middle of the Channel and meeting boats which are being escorted there by the French Coast Guard to be handed over to British vessels to take them back to Dover in something that has now been seen and shown to be an arrangement that is in place between the UK and French governments to actually ship migrants across the Channel in small boats. That's got to stop immediately, I think.
Not having a go at your faith now, I'm not at all, but some might argue, isn't it the Christian thing to do? To try and find out as much as you can about the circumstances of each person on that dinghy. And if you find a person who's got a genuine reason to be fleeing wherever they're fleeing, that as a Christian country, we should extend the hand of friendship and support and say, OK, we'll give you shelter. We'll look after you for a while as best as we can. Is that not the Christian thing to do?
No, I don't think so, because the people coming across the Channel in small boats we know are mostly military-aged men. They're coming from France, which is a safe country. There's no war in France. There's no war in the countries that they would have traveled to get to France, such as Italy or Austria or Germany or Slovenia or Croatia. The people are coming from the Middle East and from Africa. There may be a few who are genuine refugees, but most of them are economic migrants, and they've been handled by people traffickers. We know that. You know, even the French government talks about trying to stop the people trafficking gangs, because that's a big problem now in northern France with the increasing crime there, with people there. I think the best thing that we could do is try to stop the passage of boats coming across the Channel. So the economic migrants stop coming. This will cut crime down. And it's not good for this country to have so many migrants coming in most of whom are not genuine. And this is affecting our own country because we simply don't have the resources to cope with it in terms of housing, in terms of medical care, in terms of school places and all kinds of other things. It just isn't working.
David,
so, genuine asylum seekers, fine, but people who are bogus, no.
You mentioned economic migrants again, and I'm certainly no biblical scholar. I'm a lapsed Catholic and agnostic these days. But didn't Jesus teach that irrespective of what you have, you've got to give and to look after and be charitable to the person who has less? So if people are fleeing poverty, and I know they are because of the wars that were, and I'm not going to get into who started the wars, but the wars waged in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya. So people with nothing, even if they are young men, and they're coming over here because they've got nothing. Again, I'm going to put it to you for the last time because I don't want to be childish or churlish about it. But isn't the teaching of Jesus that you have a Christian duty to help out those people and give them even half of what you have if it means they'll survive and they'll prosper?
I don't apply that to the move of migration that we've got now, because if you look at the number of people who are in poverty in the world and who would like to come to Europe and maybe would like to come to the UK, if every single person in the Middle East or in Africa or India even, who was impoverished, came to the UK, well, there would be hundreds of millions of people coming. The country simply can't cope, and then the country's economy would collapse and there'd be nothing for anybody. No, and we can cope with tens of thousands of people a year, but we can't cope with hundreds of thousands and millions of people a year. It's just simply a question of scale. And yeah, absolutely, I do agree. If you can help someone, you should help them, but you can't destroy your own home and your own nation in order to help more people than we can cope with, because you know that just isn't going to work and that the whole thing will just collapse.
Yeah, and it's my opinion that many of these wars of aggression were partly down to creating the migrant flows in Europe to divide and conquer nations so that other agendas could proceed. That's just my opinion. You're listening to David Curtin. David is the founder and leader of the Heritage Party. You can catch him on TNT Radio weekdays at 10 a.m. He's a former teacher. We'll talk these education results now, but just before we do, the education news to do with how desperately poor results are in English and in mathematics particularly, and what that means going forward. But here's one from Grace. Richie, can you please ask David about children identifying as cats at schools, please? My daughter is due to start high school in September, and there are kids there that use litter trays, but the normal kids have to have a doctor's note to go to a toilet in lesson time. David, when I first heard about this identifying as cats, I thought it was just nonsense, online nonsense, you know, what you might call a panic or whatever. But it seems that this is a real thing. Are we finding, or is this actually going on? The kids are so screwed up now, in some cases, that they are identifying as animals. And not only that, but they're being pandered to, or humoured even, by their schools. What do you think about that?
It's completely insane, but it is happening. And it seems to me a very similar thing is happening now with these furries, as they're called, as to what happened with transgenders from about 2015 onwards. I'd never heard of transgenderism. You know, I was a teacher up to 2016. And then all of a sudden you started hearing more and more about transgender people, transgender kids, changing their pronouns, changing their gender, you know, wearing the clothes of the opposite sex and acting like the opposite sex. And then that got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now suddenly, 9 years after that, we've had the CAST review. And all of a sudden people have woken up and go, oh my goodness, what have we been doing to kids for the last 9 years in this country? And are kind of stopped. But now you've got this new furries thing that is coming up. And it is happening, and it is happening more in the United States. I've seen more stories about this in certain parts of the USA, you know, Washington State, California, and so on. And kids are getting the rights just to basically act how they want. And it's absolutely insane, because it seems like adults either they don't do anything because they're afraid to do something, because they're worried about, you know, they're going to be accused of impinging on children's rights or something, or there are some people who are activists who are actually actively encouraging this because they want to encourage degeneracy and for kids to get into, you just can stay in a permanent state of confused immaturity. But it is crazy. And, you know, what adults have just got to do is, you know, get these kids, give them a bit of a shake and say, no, you're not doing this. I'm not accepting this behavior. And if they want to, like, you know, act like an animal, well, they shouldn't be in school. You know, they should be sent to the funny farm, and then they'll grow out of it very quickly, I'm sure.
Here's a few headlines from The Times and The Telegraph in the last week alone that are scary enough. Pupil suspensions reach record high following lockdown school closures. We had this awful story, and I know it's a very unusual thing in Wales, didn't we, the other day, when a girl came into school with a knife and attacked some teachers. But behaviour is a big problem. Scottish school pupils taught 40 pronouns and encouraged to wear badges. And in the last 2 days, every newspaper ran with a story that says that children are doing terribly in mathematics and in English. What's going on in our schools? I know you've already touched on it, but as a former teacher, I bet you can't believe it when you hear these stories.
It's tragic, but you could see it happening. I mean, standards have been going down gradually year on year for a very, very long time. And there's all this kind of testing of kids and all where, but then the exams that they do are being made easier and easier and easier. So we say in this country, oh, there's more people have got a grade C, but a grade C doesn't mean anything much anymore if you compare it to the rest of the world. So when you do these PISA tests and, you know, in maths, English and, reading and literacy and writing and comprehension, then we come way, way behind countries like China, who are overtaking us, you know. And it's just shameful to this country. But, you know, there's no pursuit of excellence anymore. And that's what we need to get back to. You know, what I think this stems actually from before I was born. They got rid of the grammar school system. They got rid of secondary moderns, and they made everything comprehensive, which may help some people in the middle, but people who can pursue excellence can't do it anymore because they're not catered for. And then people who want to pursue a trade and an apprenticeship, who would do very well in technical skills, they can't do that anymore because there's nothing for them. Everybody is sitting in a classroom learning this sort of, you know, basic elementary things, and then being taught about pronouns, and then they're being pandered to if they want to dress up as furries. And, you know, Russia and China and India are must be laughing at us. Really, they must be, because they are still pursuing excellence. And they are leapfrogging over us. And this is absolutely shameful. And the government needs to get a grip, but they're not doing it.
Let me state an opinion on another matter, seeing as you mentioned Russia and China. So I'll state an opinion and I'll give you the final word, and then we'll part company for today. David Curtin, our guest, founder, leader of the Heritage Party, broadcaster. I'll put links to where you can listen to David and also where to find the Heritage Party online, but I'm sure you know in any case. So Sunak has been in Poland, he's been in Berlin. I should give him his proper title. I criticise the BBC when they say Putin. So we're talking about Rishi Sunak, the UK Prime Minister. He wants to put the country on a war footing and wants to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence, 2.5% of the nation's wealth. Labour says up to a point it will do the same so long as it has the money, says Labour. I don't believe that the people of China, including the Chinese government or the Russian government or the Iranians or the North Koreans, I don't believe that these nations or these peoples represent any threat to me. David, I'm tired of hearing this. I've been hearing it now for most of my life. I believe the real threat to my liberty, prosperity, and to my dignity comes from the idiots in number 10 Downing Street, the idiots in the Dáil in Dublin, and in Western European governments who are vicariously controlled by other parties. Those are the real enemies as I see them. I'm going to give you the final word for today on that, on this need to build and build and build our military to protect us from threats overseas. Final word to you, and thanks for coming back on today.
No, thanks, Richie. I totally agree with you. We have much more totalitarianism, much more moves to undermine our freedom and democracy from governments in this country and governments acting in lockstep around the Western world than we do from Russia or China or Iran or even North Korea, I think. And we've seen that very clearly over the last 4 years, where they took away our freedom in lockdowns to the point where they were sending the police round into people's homes if they had a cup of coffee with their friends. I mean, that is undermining freedom. And then Rishi Sunak has got the gall to stand up and say, oh, we need more military spending because we need to, he called them the axis of authoritarian states are becoming more assertive. And they're, he said, our democracy, freedom and the rule of law is under threat. But yeah, exactly as you said, democracy, freedom and the rule of law is not under threat from Russia. It's under threat from the fake Conservative Party and the Labour Party working in lockstep here in the UK, and it's under threat from all the other governments that we've got in the Western world, maybe with the exception of Viktor Orban in Hungary.
It's good to have you back today. Congratulations on the radio show. David Curtin is... Hey, listen, just before you go, I can't believe it. Apologies, I should have mentioned. You've got 2 minutes if you want them. 2.5 minutes. Tell us about the forthcoming elections. I know there's a general election in the offing, but there are local elections, of course, in a few weeks' time. London mayoral elections. What's the Heritage Party doing? What are you hoping to do, David?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 1 week today. It's the 2nd of May.
One week today, elections.
And London elections. So we've got candidates standing for the London Assembly. So anyone in London can vote for our candidates there on the London Assembly list. And hopefully we'll have one or two people in the London Assembly to do what I did for 5 years, which was to question the mayor and ask him all of those things. And nobody else would ask because they were too woke and too into the climate nonsense. But then we've also got candidates standing in local elections in various councils around the country, from Plymouth to Southend to Wakefield to Hartlepool and, you know, all kinds of places in between, Milton Keynes, lots of places in Surrey and so on. So we're very excited. You know, we got 34 candidates standing in local elections this year. So if you got one, that would be great, because it is so, local elections, local councils really are important to vote for because they make decisions that affect your local area. Usually the turnout is terrible, but it is a really good opportunity to vote for some people who are going to make some difference. So we're there, and we will stand more candidates in the future as we are able to.
And it's heritageparty.org. That's the website. Always great to chat, David. Thanks for coming back on. Speak soon.
Thanks, Richie.
Bye for now. David Curtin, the founder and leader of the Heritage Party, these days broadcaster too, live on The Richie Allen Show Thursday's programme. It is exactly 5 o'clock. Back shortly.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support The Richie Allen Show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Very good. I'm on the website, thank heavens. Pandora says, if your kids identify as furries or pets, etc., then, like the joke goes, treat them like a pet, tell them to sit on the floor, sleep in a basket or a kennel, eat from a bowl, use a toilet tray, walk them naked on a lead to school. Jesus, Pandora. Pandora says they'll soon snap out of it. I suppose they will. Hi to Wayne, who says, Richie, Urban Fox, I remember as a young fox growing up in Blackpool, watching Blackpool Tower being built. We would watch from the top of the tower the massive granite slabs being cut and put in place whilst Richie looked on giving instructions. Oh yeah, he means BBG towers. That's right. Very good. Which he would watch being built from Blackpool Tower. That's right. Incredible they were able to do what they did without the benefit of modern technology that we have today. Yes. Amen. Hi to Scaramouche, who says, how can anyone who celebrates St. George's Day be classed as far right when St. George was a Palestinian immigrant who lived in Turkey and who never put a foot on English soil. So Scaramouche, yes, there is that too. Paul's in Liverpool. Hi, Paul. He says, Richie, maybe the collapse of the Western economy is the final goal. Hi to Claire. Hello, Claire. Richie, I think the vast majority don't have an issue with economic migrants, so long as they are here to work and achieve their own accommodation and come here legally. I know in Ireland it's really kicking off because a lot of these people who are not international protection applicants are being put up, housed at the taxpayers' expense. You're right, Claire, of course, absolutely. And I was being the devil's advocate, yes. And of course, Ireland, the bizarre situation where many men are arriving in the country, and this has been proven, this is irrefutable, they are tearing up their documentation before they arrive. That is also true. Hi to Fran. Hello, Fran. Up here in the north of Scotland, the Furries are now literally in every high school. In my nephew's school, a boy was excluded for barking at a furry. It's insane, says Fran. I can't believe that. Let's read that again. Fran, are you serious? Listen to this. In my nephew's school, a boy was excluded for barking at a furry. It's insane, says Fran.
Fuck off.
I can't believe that, Brian.
Fuck off.
How could you exclude a child for barking at a furry? At a child who identifies as a furry? If that's really going on, Rome has fallen. No, we might as well give up. Oh, yeah. Hello, Sarah. Hi, Richie. LSA again. Today in year 7, 11-year-olds. Sitting an assessment in science today. The teacher actually had to read out all the questions on the paper and went through test step by step. When was this ever a thing, says Sarah? I don't know. I do not know, Sarah. There was no such thing when I was in school. Rob says, Richie, the teachers need to get a grip and cut this crap out. What the hell is wrong with them? And hi to Acker. Thatcher's attack on Shirley Williams for closing grammar schools as access for poor and lower middle class kids to education and a better future was one thing I agreed with and respected her for. Says Acker, said that Thatcher had it right to go after Shirley Williams at the time. It's time for a tune. It's Thursday's programme. Gerardo Colmón will be with me right shortly. Yes. I'm Richie Allen, by the way, at the BBG. And this is music from Suede. This is trash. It's all trash, I tell you. Yeah, what did Morrissey sing in Every Day Is Like Sunday? I think he sang Come, Come, Nuclear Bomb. Love this from Jan. Thanks, Jan. Richie, oh my God, if the barking thing is true, a kid barked at a furry, was excluded, the meteorite needs to come, says Jan. That's it. That's Jan's red line. That's it. If it has come to this, where children are being expelled for barking at furries in primary schools or secondary schools, it is time to check out, says Jan. I hear you, Jan. I sense your frustration. Stop it, I'm crying, says Gail. Yes, if you don't cry, if you don't laugh. Fran says, the head teacher told the boy he wasn't respecting the furry's choice of identity. It was, by all accounts, nuts, says Fran. The furries were all running around acting like scared cats and hissing at the lad. Fuck off, Fran. I mean, I know I'm Irish, right? I mean, I know I'm Irish. But stop it now. I don't think you Sassenachs realise that you've got to get up pretty early to catch Paddy. I'm not buying this, Fran. I want evidence. I'd like the kid's parent to come on the programme to tell me. Really, Fran? So a kid identifies as a furry, identifies as an animal, and a child who has got more common sense barked at the furry and was excluded. The kids who think they're furries were running around hissing at him. Fran says, honestly, Richie, honestly, Twilight Zone stuff, says Fran.
What kind of fuckery is this?
What kind of fuckery is this? Is a good question. I'm not sure. I'll need to see some hard evidence. Kay says, in my opinion, the problem with St. George is that he was a Christian who would not give up his faith, a Christian. This is the problem, in my opinion, says Kay. Thank you, Kay. It can't be going on, is it? Is it really? Is it? Kids being excluded for barking at a kid who identifies as a furry. No. Really? I think we'd have read about it. I'm going to sound very ironic now. We might have read about it in, like, the Mail or the Express, because they love that shite, don't they? Or even the Telegraph, in any case. Your messages are very welcome. Your comments, please, to richieallen.co.uk. There's also the app for the programme. You'll find it at Google Play. You'll find it at Apple's App Store. The App Store. Now, the Melodies programme returns a week on Sunday, May 5th. Okay, I keep receiving emails. And while we're waiting for Garrod to come on, I wish to jeepers I didn't leave them over there on the other side of the studio. I've been having a running battle with the Royal Mail. About 7 or 8 months ago, I ordered a mailbox address, a P.O. box address, a delivery service, whereby people would send whatever, a book they might want me to review, or maybe some support for the programme, or a card or something, to the P.O. box address, and then it would be delivered to me. And twice I've had to complain to the Royal Mail because I wasn't receiving any mail. On each occasion, they came back to me, and to the Royal Mail's credit, and it is receiving a lot of bad press lately, of course, for obvious reasons, they gave me 3 months extra free, not free, they gave me 3 months subscription by way of apologising to me. Now, the most recent time this happened was about 4 weeks ago. I hadn't received anything for ages, and I said to them, I'm not getting anything. What's going on? And they turned up with 2 letters. And I said, there must be more than that. They said, no, there isn't. Today, and my missus will bear witness, I received a bundle of them, letters and cards and books. And they're dated, many of them, November and December of last year. It is a shockingly shit service. And I'm really upset about it because people sent me things late last year, sent me messages that required a reply from me. And of course, they never got one because I didn't receive the stuff until today. And all I can say is, I'm terribly sorry, but that isn't my fault. It's the Royal Mail. I spoke to them again on the phone this afternoon and I said, hang on, you told me there was nothing left. And today you turn up with mail that was sent to me before Christmas. It's not good enough. You've got to do something about it. So let's hope they do something about it. So Garrod O'Colman should be standing by right now to speak to us live from Paris in the great France. I think what I'll do is I'll take another piece of music. I will. But before I do that, Angela has been on to say, Richie, I went to the Great Resist last Saturday, the Great Resist, and I was inspired by the good people who spoke at the event and also in the audience. Have you interviewed Dr. Sarah Myhill? She's a doctor we'd all like to have as our GP. I did interview Sarah previously and she was very good. She came on with Dr. Jane Dunnigan at one time. So thank you, Angela, and I'm glad that you enjoyed meeting people at the Great Resist. First I've heard of it, but thank you for mentioning it. Anthony says, in my son's school, a pupil was excluded for shining a laser pen on the floor. Stop now. Stop. A pupil shone a laser pen on the floor. A furry chased it. The furry ran into a wall and then knocked themselves out. Now, Brian.
Fuck off.
I don't believe that either. Right, more music. When we come back, it's Garrod O'Colman. It is The Richie Allen Show. And I'm Richie Allen. Baldy Gammon, live in Salford.
Let me ask you something. Are you out of your fucking mind?
Music from Pulp, that's a Disco 2000 on The Richie Allen Show. Now, Garrod O'Colman is due to be on. He isn't standing by. He's not there. So we'll give him a few minutes. He did ask me to put it back by a few minutes. Maybe that he's running slightly late. That's okay. It's live radio. These things happen. But I'm really anxious to get him on. First of all, because I love listening to him. But He's got a book coming out really soon. And he's tackling a few ideas in the book. One of the ideas is that the future is technological but not technocratic. And he says patriarchy is the natural order of the world and it must be restored. And I wanted to discuss those issues with him on the programme today. But he asked me earlier to push it back to about 5:15. He isn't there. We'll give him a few minutes before I have to move on. Really interesting guy, Garrido Colmon. Lives in France with his French missus. We have that in common. And their young child. You'll find him on Substack as Speardove. He's there now. Gavora Georing. Thank heavens for that. Because I didn't fancy talking to you for the next 40 minutes. You old scally. So anyway, look, you'll find him, as I said, on Twitter. Speardove he is. He's on Substack as Speardove as well. He's a journalist and a geopolitical commentator. Writes a lot about religion and philosophy. Not because he's a countryman. I love listening to him and I was fascinated to hear he started a new podcast. He's also started something called the Hum TV Network, which we might get a chance to talk about. But I really want to talk about his forthcoming book. Let's welcome back to the programme Garrido Colmon. Dia Gwit Garrod, Tá Fáilte Rocha, welcome, how are you? I put up the wrong fader, you see. You have me rattled, Garrod. I missed your answer, you have me rattled. I had the wrong fader up. Hey, listen, it's great to have you back. It really is. Before we talk about your... But what I'm going to do now is we're not going to meander. And only because we don't have as much time as we normally do. If you want to come back next week or the week after, anytime you want, we'll do an hour...
I suggest we go through. You mentioned there, I suppose, the situation in Gaza. That's kind of it's what you asked me to comment on. And
that's right, I did. But then you said you had this book coming out, and I'm fascinated by it. So we can park the book and we can talk Gaza. Look,
I'll tell you what it's about, and then I'll go into Gaza, which is related anyway. The book is called Techne and Logos, and it's basically a series of meditations on what I consider to be the meaning of technology. So it sort of culminated really in the COVID lockdowns when everybody was talking about technocracy, and something I've been thinking about for a very long time, that it seems to me that the destiny of humanity right now is technocracy. Obviously, there is a spiritual element to that, so... my argument is that technocracy is essentially a form of angelology. In other words, that it's the technical dead matter is merging with the spiritual world, with the demonic, and that is that the real meaning of technology is the marriage or the balance, if you like, between techne, which is the creative aspect of human endeavor, and logos, which is God, which is divine wisdom. And that essentially technology is meant to be that essentially, that the techne and logos are meant to be in balance. And my argument in the book essentially is that if you look at those words, if you look at the Greek techne in Greece and in Greek tragedy, techne was always considered. It was not only the word for art, but it was also the word for divination. So it was related to religion. It was art in the sense of that religion is the origin of art. And logos, of course, was the word for reason, discourse, science. It was the word taken over in everything to do with science, is where we get all of our ologies from. And it's also the word used in John's Gospel for God, for Christ. But interestingly, in the Bible, in the New Testament, the word used for God's foster father, St. Joseph, is technites. And technites has the same root. Technites is essentially a worker, but it's also, it could be a stonemason, it could be a carpenter. It's usually interpreted as a carpenter. But its essential meaning is, again, someone who is an artisan of some form. And so what kind of inspired me was a book I read in French by a priest called Lefebvre. not the famous Lefebvre of the Pirate Society, but another scholar from Switzerland. And that sort of just blew my mind, really. Kind of got me thinking about that in 2019. And so Joseph is, Saint Joseph is Technites, what he's described as, which again has the same root, it's Techne. And Christ, of course, is Logos. So, you know, in a sense, this image then of Techne holding Logos, which is, you know, which you often imagine Joseph to be doing, right? The foster father who holds Logos, man in the only man who actually saw God face to face. This idea of the father and patriarchy is, in my view, the real, this is how we solve the problem of technocracy. In other words, that in a sense, I'm trying to argue that it's already foreseen in the Bible that technology is our destiny and that it's a good thing. You know, we shouldn't be, it isn't a book against technology. I think technology is a wonderful thing. It's the reason we're having this conversation. It's the reason for the great awakening that's happening in the world. It's the reason for, it's just, you know, I'm fascinated by technology. I'm very pro, I'm not a technical person, not much good at it. But I am really fascinated by its possibilities for human liberation. And so I'm trying to argue that since the end time, whatever that means, the end of an era or the end time in sort of a religious sense is the technological era, and that our destiny, you know, the choice right now is between technology and technocracy. And so I try to argue in the book that the only way we will get to a truly technological world is a return of Christianity and a return of the role of the father, the role of patriarchy. So again, this is because, you know, the final battle really of the New World Order is the battle of the family against the family. And it's the battle really against men. Men are the only people who are, I'm not discounting women at all. In fact, I have a chapter on women. This isn't meant in a misogynistic sense, but the fact that we have had the kind of deconstruction, if you like, of the male, I mean, that's, you know, widely covered in social media and so on, means that there's no real resistance to this. There's no possibility of resistance. Even every group, every social movement, everything is corrupt. You know, even the alternative media is corrupt. You know this yourself.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
We really need to work on ourselves to be able to do anything. And so there's no point. Activism is very important, but there's also that, you know, the internal work. And so, as you know, I come from the left. So St. Joseph is a character that fascinates me because, of course, he is the patron saint of workers. And so I'm also trying to argue in the book that, you know, that we've lost the meaning of work. You know, the Hebrew word for work is avoda, which means worship and work at the same time. And so I'm fascinated with this idea of work and prayer, work as prayer, you know, like the sort of, in a way, what you do, what I do, people who are passionate about what they do, this is sort of meant to be the real meaning of work. It's almost like it's an engagement. It's something, it's not just creative, but our heart is in it. We this is who we are. And that can be, you know, whether you collect bins or whether you work in a kitchen, I think we've lost that. That's what work was meant to be. And one of the great things about Christianity is that it liberated the worker in the sense that it restored the dignity of work, which did not exist in the ancient world. So the basic worker, as Joseph represents the basic worker, essentially, the simple worker is elevated to a new level, and so that work becomes meaningful. And that's one major crisis that we have in contemporary society, is that work has lost all meaning. It, you know, and that's what happens in technocracy, where workers become a cargo machine, where you have class war, where you have, you know, the devaluation of work. And, you know, that's one of the major crises, I think, of our society. So this is another kind of theme that goes through this book, is that only Christianity will restore the dignity of the worker and restore social justice. So it's a key aspect as well. This is kind of, again, where, again, coming, I suppose, from a left-wing perspective, this is what really converted me. This is why I became, I reverted to Catholicism, because I could see that socialism was never going to do this. You know, it's never going to do this because it does not have a correct understanding of what human being is. But I'm not under any delusions about social justice, but I do, when I read the encyclicals about Catholic, social teaching, I was blown away by the Rerum, I was going to quote Lucretius now, but I was blown away by Pius the 13th's encyclicals on labour and Catholic social teaching on labour. So,
what did he say? What did Pius the 13th say about work and labour? I'm completely ignorant here now, so I'm flying blind.
Yeah, the Catholic social teaching on labour is that the worker deserves a just wage, and that the Catholicism does not support capitalism because capitalism is based on the production of profit for profit's sake, and it creates huge class conflict in society. At the same time, it rejects the notion of class struggle, because that's divisive. You know, workers, the engineer and the carpenter are meant to work together. The engineer, if you look at the Catholic social teaching on labor, it's very much like Christ didn't come to the earth to free slaves. People, a lot of people think that Christ was a socialist or he was left-wing. This is nonsense. This is complete projection of modern ideas. He doesn't even talk about freeing slaves. In fact, the slave and the master are key aspect to the meaning of Christianity. For example, in the Mass, the chapter, the passage from the Bible where Christ meets the centurion, the Roman centurion, and the centurion asks him, to cure his slave. Christ says, "Okay, I'll where is he?" And he says, "Well, look, I know who you are, and I'm not worthy to receive you under my roof, but only say the word, and my slave shall be healed." We say this in the Mass when we say, "I'm not worthy to be healed. I'm not worthy to receive you under my roof, but only say the word, and my soul shall be healed." So the relationship between the body and the soul is the relationship between the master and the slave. Now, this relation, in other words, the body dominates the soul, right? We our libidinal instinct, our appetites tend to prevail in this world, and so the soul is a slave to the body. The soul is constantly suffocated by it. And so the meaning of the Eucharist is this is food for the soul. But the Roman centurion, who was a master of the slave, owned the slave, is the ideal Christian, and yet he's a slave master. Very few people talk about that. I'm not saying we should be slave masters or that Christianity supports slavery. It doesn't. The key message here is the relationship between the slave and the master. The master is here on his knees trying to save the slave's life. He puts himself below the slave in a sense. And this is the key message. This, in other words, this is a transformation of the human being of social relations. That, there is no master, no slave. When everybody is in Christ, and this is, so what I'm arguing here is that, communism in a way is trying to replace communionism. What happens in communion is the transformation of the human. We all become one and equal through Christ, and this is revolutionary. You could use that kind of language, if people actually thought about it that way. But this is essentially the only possibility of social peace. So this is kind of what I'm trying to argue right throughout the book. I've been talking about this for quite a while, but
I would need
an hour and a half at least.
Of course, yeah. But let's pick up a couple of things that I've taken out of it. And I'm always at a very serious disadvantage when speaking to somebody scholarly. Now, you're going to deny that you're a scholar, but that's not true. You are a scholar. You're a student of the Bible of Christianity, and you've been writing about it a lot in recent years. So the book is going to be Techne and Logos, and it's coming out pretty soon. I can't wait to get a hold of it. I really mean that. Right?
I will be presenting it in the Chisinau Forum in Moldova soon. That's it's something I'm involved with Yuri Roshka, who's a good friend of mine from, and I just did my podcast with him, and I'll be doing a lot of stuff with him as well. And that will give, so that was sort of, I'll present it there, and we'll take it from there. But, you know, I you would need a lot of time to kind of go through what I'm just kind of describing, you know. It's but it's something that converted me, so I don't know, maybe hopefully people who read it will also
look,
understand where I'm coming from.
I'd love to explore it more, because some of it in short form like this will go over my head. Forget the listeners, it will go over my head. But I want to ask you, you started off talking about how the book deals with the future being technological but not necessarily technocratic. Am I to understand that you believe that and I'm very interested in this because I've watched some documentaries, I've read some books on this myself, but that the Bible is coded, that it really is coded, and that it predicts basically chapter and verse what is happening, what we're experiencing now, and where it might go, you know, where it could go left, or it could go right, or straight down the middle, and that it's predicting this, that this kind of worship of technology, which is dangerous. And you said earlier, and correct me now if I'm misrepresenting you, Garrod, but that the technology or the obsession with it can lead to demonology, or that it's got demonic aspects to it. What do you mean?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think artificial intelligence, we're entering the demonic era with artificial intelligence. Now, I think artificial intelligence per se is a good thing. I don't see anything wrong with robotics. If we have this balance between technologos in our society, you know, that we, again, you know, it simply put, if technology is dominating us, it becomes technocracy. And technocracy is tyranny, and artificial intelligence is certainly going that direction. Musk himself has warned about this. As regards the Bible and code, I'm not saying that at all. I'm not trying to find codes. You know, I'm not a biblical scholar. I mean, this really is more about sort of just this idea that I had about the role of techne and what it might mean, and the role of and what logos is, and what that might mean in our time. It's really not so much trying to find codes. I'm not trying to say that this is the meaning of the Bible either. I'm fascinated by words and etymology and philology, and this word is, you know, I'm just obsessed with this word techne, because it's the word that we use in every language to describe this time that we live in. You know, we live in the technological era. And so for me, it's trying to find out, well, what is the logos of technology?
Yeah.
What is its meaning? What is this? Is this the final frontier? And where does this go? And it struck me that here you have, you know, this story, right, where God becomes man. And it's inspired by, you know, the Blessed Trinity. It's inspired by the third person of the Blessed Trinity, the Holy Spirit. Inspires the New Testament. It creates a world civilization, the greatest civilization in history, and it the central character, you know, the character who plays the role of the foster father of God as man, doesn't say any word, but he holds the word, you know, Christ. So Saint Joseph is silent. There is no dialogue of Saint Joseph in the Bible. He's just mentioned, but he doesn't say anything. So he's, you know, and yet, and this word techne, this idea of when we think of techne as art, but also as work, as productive work, it just seems that I'm sort of extrapolating this. I'm not saying this is necessarily the meaning. I'm not saying that this is encoded, and God, I'm not trying to presume what God wanted us to think. I think we have the right to do that. As a Catholic, I kind of don't try to say, I don't have my own view of the Bible. I just refer to the fathers and whatever, and I try to keep it, you know, make sure that my interpretation is correct. I hope that what I'm saying here is correct, so I'm not trying to sort of read codes into this and say this is what he means. This is the way I read it. This is certainly the way I read it, that the very language of the very Greek of the New Testament, yes, has, you know, these are the words. This is the word. Logos is the word for Jesus, and technetes is the word for the role of Joseph. And, you know, I'm just fascinated by the etymology and the possibilities of that. And so that just sort of, that's the sort of theme that goes through. I have a long chapter on France and, you know, the history of France, the French role in the church is another long chapter on women and liberation of women, the real meaning of liberation of women in the book as well. So, but, you know, I do think that this is sort of something that needs to be thought out. And I do think that, you know, there is, that we are, if we can recuperate some meaning of technology, then we can escape the tyranny that's coming. But if not, we will enter into a very demonic era.
We'll succumb.
We've
to
already
it.
Entered it, really.
Yeah.
You know, when they're talking about facial technology now.
Yeah.
And they're saying that, you know, artificial intelligence can tell what political ideology you have. I mean, we won't be able to step outside our front door if that's the case, you know.
Yeah, they're developing they're developing a way to, for a machine to scan a person's face and determine from biomarkers exactly what that person is thinking. I know this sounds ridiculous, but you're right to bring this up. And you mentioned something earlier on that there's almost an evangelical fervor around this when it comes to a certain generation. I hate to bash the youngsters all the time because I love them. I love them because, you know, they have it a lot harder than I did when I was 23, 24. I didn't have to deal with any of this shit, you know. But there is an evangelical fervor. There's an absolute desire for this stuff, you know. It's almost rapture-ish, the excitement around the tech. And, yeah, it kind of spooks me at times. I live in a very young place, Garode, a very young neighborhood. And I see it with my own eyes, and it's not good.
I suppose what I'm trying to argue here as well, and this is a movement we see happening in the world. You know, I probably told you this before, but I was in Tehran at a conference. Michael Jones is a friend of mine. We were there together in Tehran for a conference, and Michael Jones, with his sort of, he's that Germanic, that very serious, gaunt Germanic stare, he said, "God sent me to save you from communism." And he sat me down, and we had a long chat for about 2 hours. I'd say it must have been an hour, or maybe 2 hours, in a lounge in a hotel in Tehran. And that I mean, I was coming back to the Catholic Church at that point, but after that I went back to France, and that was it. I started to try to pick up the bits and pieces of my life and try and get things in order. That took a while, and still taking a while to do that. Like yourself, same generation. I come from an atheistic background, very left wing. Came from that detritus of postmodern Ireland, the decline of everything and the destruction of everything, and the kind of abyss that was left. And we're seeing, you know, now just the, you know, complete obliteration of everything. But you know, interestingly, on Catholicism, you know, But I mean, there was a lot of other people in France that sort of influenced me as well. But it was just my reading, really, that and the fact that, you know, reason, logos, is what we lack in the modern world, and scientism is not providing that. It's all irrational. You know, we're dominated by pseudoscience, from climate changeism to bogus theories about sexuality. To everything is based on pseudoscience and ideological rubbish.
And there's a lack of fulfillment.
Nobody seems to have any kind of analysis.
Yeah.
What I found is that, you know, the when I read St. Augustine, I'm just blown away by how contemporary it is and how rational it is. So it was really, I suppose, like my background is in philosophy. So that's kind of what I was always passionate about, the search for truth. That's the reason why I got into politics, really, to find out what the truth is. You know, I'm a truther like you. So, you know, that people who look for the truth tend to find it. You know, and we see a movement right now in the world where truthers, people like Candace Owens, for example. I mean, some people say she's controlled opposition or whatever. I don't follow her very closely, but I've seen her in recent times, and I've seen her, you know, her courage and so on. And she's recently converted to Catholicism. That's something that's happening, I think. There's a huge conversion happening in France of adults, mostly from atheistic backgrounds. So it seems to me that a lot of people are seeing here, we might say, the spiritual element of what's going on. I would call it the religious element, the openly religious element of the New World Order. There is a religiosity here. There is an actual religion. Freemasonry is the religion. It's a big part of it. It's never mentioned, hardly ever mentioned. Even in the alternative media, very few people talk about it, but it's there. We can see it in Hollywood. We can see it, you know, the so-called Illuminati, the you know, Freemasonic symbolism is ubiquitous. Can't escape it. So there is, whether we like it or not, we live in a religious society. So this, for me, was something I just had to face up to. You know, it's not something like you. I come from a similar background. I was very atheistic, very left wing. So I was very reluctant to see this in a way for a long time. I could see it, but I was kind of thinking maybe it's not the only way of viewing things. But, you know, at the end of the day, you just have to face up to reality. And a lot of people are seeing that reality.
That's interesting, so kind of that there might be some.
Do you want to be the ship of Satan or Christ? And just take, and there is no third way.
There is a spiritual vacuum, and whether people are conscious of it or not, they are experiencing it. They might not be aware of it, and this might be leading people to go looking. And you mentioned Candace Owens. I've been reading that story today. I find it absolutely fascinating. I genuinely do. I want to go back to something you said, because we've only got 10 minutes left from here. Look, come back on in a week or two, we'll do a longer segment at your leisure, by the way. But I like this patriarchy thing that you talk about. I don't mean to be rude when I say thing, but I like it because, yeah, for I've noticed for several years a kind of a denigration of what it is to be a man or a male, coming from all quarters, coming from everywhere, you know, and values that were traditionally male, you know, stoic or stoicism, you know, an ability to internalize your struggles but to deal with them, not to burden your family, your wife, your girlfriend, your partner, whatever, to deal with things. I know I'm being very general here now, but a kind of
what
an assault.
What you just mentioned there, sorry to interrupt.
Go on.
What you just mentioned there about stoicism is very important, because I've just written a long essay on Pontius Pilate, which I've been bringing out into, and it's kind of a defense of Pontius Pilate. I won't say why, because take another hour to say why I'm defending Pontius Pilate as a Christian, as a Catholic. But anyway, it is a defense of Pontius Pilate. You know, he was considered a saint in the early church. Even Saint Augustine considered Pontius Pilate to be a saint. Now, people can read the essay to see that. I won't go into it here. But you mentioned Stoicism. And, you know, I've been reading, I was in Greece recently, I bought a book by Epictetus, and I was reading Stoic philosophy again. And this, you know, the Romans were very Stoic, you know, like Christianity took root in a Stoical society. And, you know, this was a very manly society, it was very virile, you know. So Pontius Pilate was, nobody really knows what he was like, but there is one view that he would have been sort of, he would have come from that stoical world. He was quite masculine, in the proper sense of the term. Now, it's just when you mention that stoicism, you know, that I think that is coming back, that appreciation of stoicism, the appreciation of I want to kind of be very clear that there's also an actually toxic masculinity out there, represented by people like
you don't mean guy got Andrew Tate. You don't mean him, do
Tate?
You?
Yeah, Andrew Tate. Exactly. Just, you know, he's, you know, this guy's a pimp. You know, made money from abusing women. And now he's, you know, like, so obviously this is some kind of psyop, this guy's involvement. But like, you know, St. Joseph is an example of a real man. And so I think certainly the return of an interest in all of that is something that is going to happen naturally, because there is no choice. You know, people are going to also see that this is the only way to resist the New World Order. You know, that this is a theocracy they're building here. And whether one likes it or not, And
but to a demon
so there's
god,
kind of no way
believe.
There's and there's certainly no political solution to this. I mean, what political leader in the world can you trust today? You know, we have a lot of the alternative media. I've spoken to you about this before. A lot of the alternative media talking about, you know, the BRICS, and I've written about it myself. You know, as a kind of an alternative world order and so on. But BRICS has completely signed up to the World Economic Forum, the objectives of, you know, the 21st century objectives of the UN, you know, 2030 objectives.
And the WHO, yeah.
And just about every consensus issue, you know, is silenced in every one of those countries, whether it's climate pseudoscience or whether it's maggot food, you know, that they're imposing. It's I mean, you know, people talk about Russia. I mean, the whole, you know yourself, I mean, I contributed a lot to Russian media and still do, but I mean, 10 years ago, I was, you know, contributing a lot to Russia Today. And to, you know, Russia was playing the geopolitical game, but that doesn't mean that Russia or Putin is an alternative to this. You know, as you know yourself, Putin was a member of the World Economic Forum. The Russians are heavily involved in the project of the World Economic Forum, still are. Pretty much Putin is surrounded by World Economic Forum advocates, and his domestic program in Russia, though it looks and appears Christian, and certainly that should be commended. And, it, you know, it's a bit like Trump. It's a complex kind of program there.
Can you can I jump in? It's important. Russia. Hang on. It's important I jump in there.
Yeah.
Can you prove? I don't mean you've got to do it right now because we've only got 4 or 5 minutes anyway. But can you prove? Have you got names of people who are in the, you know, the inner circle in Moscow who are World Economic Forum advocates and that they are influencing Putin?
Can you be certain? Yes, well, Mr. Marashko.
Right.
And the man responsible for a genocide in Russia. They have the highest, they have a huge mortality rate since the introduction of the Sputnik vaccine. And Marashko's still there. Now, this is a World Economic Forum, and he's, in fact, the Russians were key actors in creating the consensus about COVID and at the United Nations from the very start. That's why they brought out the first vaccine. You know, the Sputnik vaccine was also ready long before the crisis, you know. So
this is what I believe.
And there is a huge increase in mortality in Russia. They have the biggest increase in mortality in Russia since the Second World War, which is pretty big considering, you know, Russia's problems since the Second World War, you know. It's the same. And not only that, but they're bringing in mandatory vaccines in Russia. They're talking about, they're going to sign up, I believe, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe that they're going to sign up to the health world, the
pandemic UN, treaty
the
planning
world,
thing, yeah.
Yeah, health organization treaty that they're bringing out. They're signing up to that.
But did you not hear? Sorry, Garrod. Sorry, Garrod.
Not only that, Richie, but they censored all dissidents during the lockdowns. They censored any scientist. There's many, many scientists in Russia who denounced the entire COVID scam, and they were silenced in Russia, you know. So
can I just echo something you said there? Listen, the independent media is full to the brim of idiots who advocate for Russia and pretend that Vladimir Putin is some sort of messiah. It is as corrupt. I have said from day one, I believe every government on planet Earth is captured. And that's my opinion. I've always said it. I treated Putin the same way I treated Rishi Sunak or Boris Johnson. I've always done. I suppose that's what sets maybe this show apart from pretty much everything else in the independent media. That's what I believe. In any case, this is true. I'm just mindful of time, and I want to. There was something else I wanted to say or to ask you before. We do run out of time today, and it's on Israel. It's on Gaza because. You have a huge following, and people who listen to this program in particular, they trust that what you're saying is what you believe, whether it's right or wrong. On what's happening in Israel today, the BBC World Service, I've been listening to it this morning, listened to Morning Ireland and RTE, they're talking about Israel, and we've literally only got 2.5 minutes, so you've got to be quick with your answer. Placing thousands of tents near Khan Yunis. and telling people to get out of Rafah and to go and to Palestinians to go to these tents before Israel goes in to Rafah. Are we looking at the possibility or the likelihood in the coming days or weeks of a massacre that might even dwarf what we've seen in the last 5 or 6 months? And if so, is there anything that can stop that?
I think they are certainly ready to go into Rafah. It looks like that's going to go ahead, but it may not be, you know, worse than what we've seen. I think it'll be probably a continuation of what we see, of what we've seen. They've already killed people in Rafah, so they're already they've already targeted that city. But I think, you know, we have to look at the global situation here as well. The protests that are taking place in the United States in the universities now. This is another front, really, for this war, in the sense that Netanyahu has come out and condemned it and said it has to stop. Now, these protests are taking place in universities across the United States. Yeah. This is taking place in France. And, you know, this is going to explode if this continues. These protests are, to a certain extent, led by people like Soros. You know, Soros is funding anti-Zionism for a very long time. Soros, of course, is a political Judaic in the sense that his goal is a Judaic world order, but he's kind of funding fake anti-Zionism, and a lot of it is led by that. But there's a lot of very sincere people, very very good people in those movements as well, who are genuinely concerned about what's happening. And I think that, like we're seeing in social media, people like, we just mentioned Owens, and all these people are speaking up, and they're certainly not in the, you know, the Soros camp. Or so this is exploding, and I think it's getting out of control. The narrative is getting out of control, and there's a lot of independent voices emerging. So I think we're at a critical moment, really, where dissidents now, you know, people are breaking out of sort of traditional left-right categories. People don't really care about how they're categorized. I think we're you know, it's sort of there's an explosion now of dissidents of all kinds, and I think that the attempt to ban TikTok by the Israelis, you know, through America, you know, through their colony, is very indicative of just how there is a sea change, particularly among the youth, taking place that they're very worried about.
Do me a favour, will you? Do me a favour. We're bang out of time. I've got to get out, right, because we're nearly at the top of the hour. You'll find Garrod on Substack, Speardove Post. He's on Twitter, at Speardove, spelt as it sounds. I'll put the links on the podcast notes. This happens too often when you come on. We run out of time. Let's make a proper time. Let's make a proper 2 hours available for the next time you come on, because there's so much that we could extrapolate out from things we were talking about earlier on. But I love listening to you, pal. Thanks for your time. I really mean that.
Thanks for inviting me on again, Richie, and great to talk to you.
My pleasure, Garrod. Godspeed to you. Bye for now. Garrod O'Colmone, live from Paris, journalist, political commentator, writing a lot about religion and philosophy. He's got a fascinating new book coming out right soon, and we will make time to discuss the book in a lengthy interview when it is published. Great to have him back on the programme today. But that's about it for the programme. Thank you for listening. Thanks to David Curtin for coming on in the first hour. The Papers podcast will be online tomorrow morning around about 7:30. Please listen to the Papers podcast. Do share it with others. The Richie Allen Show back Monday. It's all back to normal now. And the Melodies programme will return a week on Sunday. That is a week on Sunday, the Melodies. It's had a good few weeks now off, and I needed that. I needed a break from it. And I'm really excited about doing it again, because I love doing that. I love getting up on a Sunday, preparing that, and chatting away with you while you're cooking your Sunday lunch or your Sunday roast or whatever it is. So, if I don't hear you, or if you don't hear me tomorrow, have a fantastic weekend. It's over and out from the BBG. Closing out with Sammy Davis Jr. then.